Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to a meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. I am Ladaris Cordell, a retired California Superior Court judge and former chair of the Santa Clara County Jail Commission, and I'm your moderator for the program this evening. Tonight's program will address policing in America, force, surveillance, and the future. As the debate about out-of-control policing continues, we're going to discuss threats to constitutional rights involving the use of force and surveillance by law enforcement agencies and how those threats can be kept in check. So I'm now pleased to introduce our panelists. Barry Friedman is one of the country's leading authorities on constitutional law, policing, criminal procedure, and the federal courts. He's also the author of the new book, Unwarranted, Policing Without Permission, which will serve as a basis for our discussion. Mr. Friedman is the founding director of New York University Law School's Policing Project and the reporter for the American Law Institute's Principles of Law Policing. He publishes regularly in the nation's leading academic journals in the fields of law, politics, and history. Professor Friedman holds a law degree from Georgetown University. George Gascon is a district attorney for the city and county of San Francisco and has a 30-year career in law enforcement. He has earned a national reputation for using evidence-based practices to lower crime and make communities safer. Mr. Gascon's career has taken him through the ranks of the Los Angeles Police Department from a patrol officer all the way to assistant chief. He also served as chief of police in Mesa, Arizona, and chief of police in San Francisco. He is the first Latino to hold the office of district attorney in San Francisco and the nation's first police chief to become a district attorney. And Jennifer Grenick is the new Surveillance and Cybersecurity Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. She litigates, speaks, writes about privacy, security, technology, and constitutional rights. Her work is so well known in privacy and security circles that one U.S. senator has called her an NBA All-Star of surveillance law. Her 2016 book, Surveillance, Why You Should Care and What to Do About It, was awarded the Palmer Civil Liberties Prize. Ms. Granick devoted most of her career helping create Stanford University Law School's Center for Internet and Society and served as the center's executive director. She later served as Civil Liberties Director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And previously, she has spent nearly a decade practicing criminal defense law in California. So please welcome our panelists. Welcome. All right, so let's kick things right off here. And I'm going to start, even though I call on one of you, if you have something to add to it, just go right ahead. So I'm going to start with Professor Friedman. Professor Friedman, so you write in this terrific book, Unwarranted, that the Fourth Amendment is at the core of policing, be it when police patrol the streets or when they patrol in the cloud. So could you give us all a quick primer on the Fourth Amendment and how it pertains to policing?
Sure, Judge. I'd be glad to. First, I just want to thank you and everybody else for being here. It's a great panel. I'm excited to talk about all this. So the main way that we regulate policing in the United States is through the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And when I say policing, as the judge indicated, it's everything from what you think of as street policing, stop and frisk, use of force questions, all the way to surveillance, whether it's license plate readers or facial recognition. All of this is regulated by one part of the Constitution. And this is pretty much what the Fourth Amendment says. It says, people have a right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. That's the the core of the entire thing. There's also a clause about what warrants need to look like and probable cause. But the main regulation of all of this entire range of policing is just that little bit that says no unreasonable searches and seizures. And so, you know, the question you might ask is, what's unreasonable? I mean, that's just one word. And who decides? And what we've largely done in this country is turn the answer to that question over to judges. And one of the things I argue in the book is that's a terrific mistake. It's not led us down a very good path, and we need to think of another way of proceeding. And the way that I suggest that we proceed is pretty radical, which is that we do it through democracy, that we actually let the people have a voice in deciding what policing should look like.
So you want to talk a little more about...
Sure. So, you know, if you think about government and how government runs, there's a set of sort of basic principles that everybody knows. We have rules. We put those rules in place before officials act. They're transparent. We all know what the rules are. And not only do we know what the rules are, but we ask the public to be involved in writing the rules. And then we try where we can to do a little cost-benefit analysis and make sure that the rules do more good than harm. And that's how government runs in most areas, whether it's the school board or environmental protection. That's just the sort of heartbeat of democracy.
So you mean there are public meetings, right? People come. I was on a city council, so people come in and they hear everything and they can have input, and that's how government works.
Sometimes they're happy, sometimes they're unhappy with government, but they get their say.
And policing?
Policing, not so much. So, you know, I distinguish these days between front-end accountability, what we just talked about, and back-end accountability, which is things go wrong in government all the time, of course, and often we go to judges to get them to fix that part. But in policing, we don't do any of that front-end. I mean, many of the rules around policing are not even public, and if they are public, we certainly don't ask people what they think the rules should be. And instead, when we talk about accountability in policing, and you hear us talk about it all the time, we talk about the back end after things have gone wrong. We have courts, and we have civilian review boards, and we have inspectors general. If you think about it, even body cameras, which we all talk about a great deal and we'll probably end up talking about tonight, body cameras are a form of back-end accountability. We don't step in until something's gone wrong, and then we try to figure out, you know, whether to cast blame, what the problem was. But what we don't do is ask people up front, how do you want to be policed? And that's the question that I think we need to start asking.
Wow. Okay. So, George Gascon, racial profiling and excessive uses of force by law enforcement, and it continues to be a huge issue, especially in communities of color. So, for example, Professor Friedman writes about warrantless police stops of individuals who fit the drug courier profile, which is utilized by some police agencies that patrol major airports. And people fit the drug profile if they, and I'm taking this right from the book, and I found it astounding. So you're fit the profile of a drug courier if, ready? This is airport. Arrived at night, arrived early in the morning. One of the first to deplaned in the middle, used a one-way ticket, used a round-trip ticket, traveled alone, traveled with a companion, acted too nervous, acted too calm, walked rapidly through the airport, walked aimlessly through the airport. So, I mean, you all get the picture. So one response to stop racial profiling has been advocating for the use of body-worn cameras to ensure that those on both sides of the camera behave. But a just-released study of 2,000 police officers in Washington, D.C. showed, and this was in the New York Times recently, that body-worn cameras had almost no effect on officer behavior. So should we stop spending taxpayer dollars on these body-worn cameras? And if not, why not?
Great question. Let me begin by saying that I agree with the thesis of the book. I've read most of it. I think I'm missing only about 25 pages. And I also want to put on the record that I do believe that especially the African-American community historically has been impacted through racist policies and practices by law enforcement. So I want to park there because it's important to have that contextually what I'm going to say next. Having said that, I also believe, for instance, when we're talking about body-worn cameras, I believe that it's nuance. And while I understand that the recent study of the D.C. police, you know, came up with certain outcomes, which I'm not questioning because I don't know enough about to question them. I also know that there are other jurisdictions where we have seen the use of body-worn cameras actually reduce officer use of force and reduce public complaints in settings where the public complaints are not filtered by the police, meaning in places, communities where people actually can complain to a third party, arguably unbiased repository of complaints so that people may feel more comfortable reporting officer misconduct. And I understand, by the way, that officer misconduct is terribly underreported, but there are gauges that you can go by. And so to me, the issue of body-worn cameras is not whether we should have them or not. I think it really comes down to policy and how the policies to the use are created, who gets access to the information, how is the information reviewed, how is the information used. Bringing you to the local, our own local jurisdiction, you know, San Francisco had a very robust public conversation around equipping San Francisco police officers with body-worn cameras. And while I purposely had my office stay out of that conversation because we did not want to be conflicted by our participation, given that we're a recipient of that work, we thought that the process was generally a good, robust process. And yet, at the very end, at the 11th hour, there were some negotiations that took place with a union, and all of a sudden what we saw, the end product, was not necessarily the product that we certainly were following along the lines when we were seeing the development of the policy. So you have to ask yourself, well, is this the body-worn cameras, or is it the lack of political will to actually do the right things and take a tool that could, in fact, be a useful tool across the board, by the way, not only when it comes to police misconduct, but I have to tell you that often we're able to gather evidence in domestic violence cases, sexual assault cases, that facilitate our work in determining whether we're going to prosecute a case or not, and if we are prosecuting, being able to show to a jury what the officers and what was the scene like and what was happening at the time. It's a two-dimensional process, right? It's never going to give you full context of the scene. There are many other things that are happening. Unfortunately, in many jurisdictions, including our own, officers are often muting the sound. They're turning the cameras off, sometimes accidentally, sometimes intentionally, sometimes for good reason, sometimes we're not sure why. You can speculate as to why. So there are a lot of infirmities in how you use body-worn cameras, but I believe that assuming that eventually we get to the political will to make sure that these things are used appropriately and the information is shared responsibly, because I believe in responsible transparency, I think it's a tool that we should not walk away from. We just simply need to look at the Washington Police Department, Washington D.C. Police Department, and say, how is it that your behavior hasn't been adjusted? Because, quite frankly, most of us is just human nature. If I know that I'm being videoed, I'm generally going to try to be in my best behavior, right? Which is a good thing, right, for both of us. You know, it reduces the likelihood that I may overreact, that the officer may use force at the other party. So I think the fact that the study is showing that there has been no behavioral modification tells me that there are some really bad policies that need to be looked on.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I just want to jump in because I think the wrong message to take away from the D.C. study is body cameras are a waste. I'm ambivalent about body cameras. I worry about them. If you think about it in one sense, we've installed the largest surveillance system we've maybe ever seen in this country with all the officers walking around with cameras. And I think George is exactly right. You know, what happens ultimately with the cameras is going to depend on what the policies look like. And one of the problems with the policies very often is that footage is not disclosed at a time that the public most might want to see it. But there is, you know, it was a very good study in one sense in the District of Columbia, but there were some problems with it. And it's interesting to just note one of them because it's kind of fascinating if you think about it. So one of the things that the study found was that uses of force didn't drop appreciably when the cameras were on. But if you think about what's going on, it's possible, don't know, it's possible, that in fact what happened is because the officers were wearing the cameras, they reported uses of force more frequently because they knew that there was the video of that. And so you can't be sure if, in fact, part of what happened is just that we had more reporting of uses of force rather than the same sort of constant.
But, you know, one thing I find that just makes no sense to me is that I find police departments around the country running to get grants to buy these body-worn cameras. Without first developing the protocols for the use of them, because that'll determine what kind of camera you get. Because there are some cameras that have different features on them. Some actually activate as soon as an officer gets out of a car, for example. But the protocols, it seems to me, are what should be developed by public input. That once you know how they're going to be used, when they're going to be used, and what the repercussions are for not using them, and once they're in place, I think then the public then has more of a sense of trusting that these cameras are going to hold officers accountable as well as the public. Let me move to another subject. Jennifer, technology has changed policing forever. License plate readers, drones, GPS, cell phone towers, facial recognition are some of the fast-growing technologies that have given law enforcement just this whole panoply of surveillance tools. So some people worry that with these tools, there's no such thing as privacy anymore. And that, as Professor Friedman opines in his book, today we have all become suspects. Do you agree? Is privacy a myth? And can you tell us?
I can go home then. My job is done. I lost.
And can you tell us about the ACLU's community control over police surveillance legislative effort? Yeah.
Let me talk a little bit about that and then go to the broader question. You know, the community control over police surveillance program is very much along the lines of what we've been talking about here. The idea of getting democratic public involvement in choices about policing and surveillance technology, and setting up those processes for what are the protocols going to be, what are the proper rules going to be, and how are we going to ensure that these devices are used properly. So what the program is essentially is a way for communities to pass legislation that ensures that there's public input in decisions about what kind of technology for policing to purchase. So that there's a public hearing with notice that people can show up to and talk about, so that there can be democratic involvement in decisions about whether to adopt body cameras or street cameras or facial recognition technology or license plate detection, and that there are procedures in place that deal with the important questions and policies raised by these technologies: data retention, auditability, discoverability by defendants, accessibility by public agencies and inspectors general, and that sort of thing. So it's really an effort to kind of start to see through, Barry, some of what you know we're talking about as being needed in this realm. You know, in terms of, and I think that's just one of many examples of why privacy isn't dead, to get to the bigger question. You know, technology poses a unprecedented challenge to privacy, as well as a challenge to policing and a resource for policing as well. But technology is only one of the things that regulates our world. And there are other things that regulate our world too. We talk about them as like the four things: technology, law, norms, and there's one other that I'm forgetting right now. But the thing that's important here is that law plays this very important Law plays this very important role in regulating how these technologies are used and ensuring that people still have that realm of privacy, which is really fundamentally important. Because while I agree that it's a good thing when police officers doing their jobs are observed to ensure that the immense amount of power that comes with that job is being exercised responsibly. For the rest of us, we want to be unobserved so that we can do the crazy, creative, inventive stuff that we do without fear of reprisals or shame or anything like that. And so, you know, having that freedom to experiment, to fail, to be ourselves is like just a fundamental part of being human and a really important part of democracy. And to me, that's one of the things that's most interesting about your book, Barry, is the idea that, you know, we would get people to be democratically committed to preserving this realm of privacy for us. You know, when I think about the Bill of Rights and the Fourth Amendment as part of the Bill of Rights, I mean, one of the things about the Bill of Rights is it's counter-majoritarian. It protects our rights against what the public might want, against what a mob might ask for, and says, you know, even if everybody thought it was a great idea to go into everyone's house and look for drugs because drug dealers are bad, we don't allow that to happen. And so I think there's this balance between democratic accountability and public commitment to making sure that policing is responsive to our needs, and then kind of the fundamental underlying safeguard of the Constitution, which is to ensure that there's a baseline below which we don't fall.
But let me push that back a little, because you just said, you know, the law, and we don't allow people to just, that law enforcement to just come in your house when they want to. And I say to that, yet. We don't allow it yet. And that brings up a question I'm going to pose to Professor Friedman. In Unwarranted, you list a myriad of searches that law enforcement can conduct without warrants. So they include, and just to give you an idea, immigration checkpoints, no warrants, consent searches, searches of welfare recipients, students, parolees, government employees, inventory searches, search incident to arrest, no warrants, automobile searches, and there are more. So, Professor Friedman, you write that these exceptions have pretty much eviscerated the Fourth Amendment's requirement for a search warrant, and you blame judges for it. And here's a quote from your book. I think the judiciary should be ashamed. Confronted with situations in which the police have done the most inappropriate and untoward things, too many judges simply cannot bring themselves to cry foul. So I want you to talk to us a bit about your view of the judiciary. I mean, I was on the bench for, you know, nearly 20 years, and I had to approve search warrants when they occasionally came on my desk. So talk to us about what's going on with the judiciary locally, but also, you know, with the Supreme Court. Have they so undermined the Fourth Amendment that the whole warrant requirement just doesn't mean anything anymore?
So yes, they have. I stand by those words. I agonized over them. Many of my best friends are judges. I've been a law professor and a lawyer for over 30 years. I've spent a lot of time in court. I have a, you know, genuine respect for the system of justice in this country, but I think judges have done us a terrible disservice. And I want to tie that into what Jennifer just had to say, which is we've made a mistake in sort of turning all of this over to judges and then thinking we don't have a role. But there's this incredibly advancing technology. It gives the government an extraordinary ability to see everything about us at any moment of our lives, should it wish to, from, you know, hacking into our computers and activating the cameras. I was just at a conference and I noticed that a bunch of the privacy-oriented lawyers all had, you know, something over the camera on their computer because they're conscious that that can in fact happen. There are Stingray devices that can track our cell phones. There are cameras everywhere, including now on police officers. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I think we as a society have to think through it. And I, you know, I should also say, because you get about this far into a conversation and it seems otherwise, I'm a big fan of law enforcement. The policing project that I run works hand in glove with law enforcement agencies all over this country. It's just that there are fundamental questions that we as a society need to ask. And though the Fourth Amendment is always there as a theoretical backstop, should we get there, where the judges can say, you know, the people have lost their mind and the Constitution doesn't let them do this, the people ought to make the decisions first. And so, you know, I'll just give you two examples that everybody can chew on. So one is stingrays. I often ask people to raise their hands if they know what a stingray device is. And in fact, I'm going to do it. Who knows what a stingray device is? And who doesn't? Never heard of it. Right. So there's a reason you haven't heard of it. The reason you haven't heard of it, Stingray devices are devices that trick your cell phone into pinging them and allow law enforcement to locate a phone. Terrifically valuable tool. I mean, imagine a kidnapper that law enforcement's trying to track down. The reason you don't know about them, though, is because law enforcement agencies acquired Stingrays under a deal that, you know, they had to sign agreements with not only the manufacturer but the FBI to never reveal the existence of the technology. And it caused them to either not go to courts for orders, to lie to judges about how they were getting orders or how they were going to get this information. There were cases that were dropped in the middle because it was clear that the law enforcement individual on the stand was going to have to say something about Stingrays. And to me, it's untenable that technologies like this would be deployed and not sort of get the say-so from the people. Then judges, just to give you the second example, you know, judges have approved of all kinds of things that I find unimaginable. The craziest of which, just for me, people wince when they hear this, so prepare to wince, is that there are a number of departments, particularly out west, that, you know, they're dealing with people driving under the influence. And if it's alcohol, then you can do a breathalyzer, easy enough. But if it's drugs, it's tougher. In a number of departments, you know, the police just take people to the hospital and forcibly catheterize them. And judges signed off on this, and I find that remarkable and think, you know, before we go down that road as a society, we should be asking, is this something we want to do? Is it worth the candle? And only then even pose the question to judges.
So I know, for example, that Stingrays, Oakland PD, Sacramento PD, San Jose PD, San Francisco, they have Stingrays. So George Gascon, was there public input before the Stingray in San Francisco was purchased? And I do know the company that makes them makes the department sign a non-disclosure agreement. They're not allowed to disclose, period.
He can't tell you.
They'll have to kill me then.
And then also, you know what the police departments do with the information that's collected by the Stingray?
Yeah. So I think when you heard the introduction, you probably noticed if you were awake that I started in L.A., went to Arizona, and then San Francisco. Actually, I have never, I was a chief of police here for 16 months. I was not even aware that they had Stingrays in their inventory. I do not know whether they have, and today I can tell you that certainly both as a chief of police and the DA have never seen a Stingray case out of San Francisco Police Department. So let me put there. But I am aware, you know, for instance, when I was in L.A., it was occasionally used. And when I say occasionally, really very, very rarely, we acquired the technology in 2004. At the time, there were no public hearings. I grant you that. I don't think anybody even thought, you know, frankly, the technology, although the technology is about 20 years old, it was sort of new to local law enforcement. And in the L.A. experience and then in the Arizona experience, which I saw being used, although the police department there did not own it, but we worked through our federal partners, it was always with a particularized case, pinging a particular phone. And in my experience, it dealt with, and I think I have enough fingers in my hands, murder cases, attempt murder. I remember of a rape case in Arizona, and then a barricaded armed suspect within a building and trying to locate exactly where this person was located because this person had fired a rifle several times prior to police arrival, and the location was contained. So to Barry's point, this is useful technology if it is used appropriately. I am personally not aware of a case where wholesale capturing of data about people was being captured in catalog. I'm not saying that it hasn't occurred. I just personally am not aware of it. Having said all of this, I do believe that it should be for a local community to implement the use of this technology should be discussed publicly. There should be a public understanding of, A, what the capacity is, and B, under what conditions would the technology be deployed. I believe in the term that I like to call responsible transparency. And I don't believe that the public, while an investigation is going, may have a right to know that we're targeting somebody that is wanted for a serious and violent crime. But I do believe that the community has a right to have input as to when would this technology be implemented, if at all. And there should be accountability and auditing process, and I think that's important. And frankly, I want to kind of, you know, sort of tag on to this a little, because this is something that Barry and I discussed earlier. Barry, you know, I have a great deal of respect for Barry. But I think it's unreasonable for us in today's complex world to expect our judicial branch to be the police of the police. I think that we need to start thinking about other avenues. And I'm not so sure, frankly, that local bodies such as police commissions and inspector generals and local monitors are also equipped to come up with national policy on these issues. You know, we regulate communication at the national level. We regulate how we fly airplanes. Granted, under the new administration, I'm not sure that we're going to regulate the environment, but ideally we would. I think that we need to start thinking at the national level, how do we create sort of the ground floor for police regulation where, you know, localities can go beyond that, but they cannot go below that. You know, we have 17,000 police agencies roughly in this country. We have, you know, police officers that are, their training and their selection process vary from one extreme to the other. Some jurisdictions, they may be, you know, you are now a friend of the sheriff. Here's a badge. Go enforce the law all the way to major metropolitan centers where they have a different selection process and everything in between. And frankly, most of the developed world will look at they do, because I have been engaged in policing around the world. They look at our system as insane, you know, that you don't have national sort of minimum requirements for selection, for training, for regulating the process. And I know that it goes contrary to some of the concepts of, you know, the federalism and, you know, local control. But, you know, the way that policing was looked upon in this country over 200 years ago is very different than what we have today, and we have to adjust to that.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Just on the stingray, if I may, sure. I think one of the biggest problems there is secrecy. And I think that secrecy has really polluted our legal oversight of surveillance more generally. I mean, particularly in the intelligence context, which ropes in all kinds of surveillance, but also in the regular run-of-the-mill policing as well. Okay. And the stingray is a perfect example of that. Yep. It was a technology that we suspected existed for many years but couldn't prove. And then ultimately, when the police department started to have to admit in court cases that they were using this technology, we had to struggle through FOIA requests and litigation to try to learn things about it.
Tell them what a FOIA is.
A Freedom of Information Act request, so to the government to give documents that tell you about the process of buying it or what the technology is capable of doing. And, you know, one of the things we learned is, you know, by the very nature of the way a stingray works, if I had one here, every single one of your cell phones would connect to it. That is how it works. That's how it finds. So if I'm looking for the judge, then I look through all the identifiers from all the phones. It's also by causing you to connect to it, stopping your phone from connecting, perhaps temporarily, but to a real cell tower, which means you may not get cell service for a while. And then what happens with all that data that's generated? So you're really able to do things that you were never able to do before. In other words, sort of tell everybody who was in a particular room, everybody who was near an AA meeting, everybody who was at a particular political protest or something like that. And the question is, what kind of legal process, what kind of oversight do police need to use that? And police were routinely using this, and I believe still routinely use it without going and getting a warrant or having to show probable cause, and they use it with a lesser legal process.
So, Jennifer, let me go ahead.
Yeah, very quickly, though, as of January of 2016, California law enforcement has to get a search warrant to use it.
Right.
California is really a leader.
It is, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we're all going in the same direction here. So first I'll just push back on the direction that we're going to say, there are folks in law enforcement that would certainly say, the problem is if we let you know about the technology, then the bad guys will know about the technology, and so the value of the technology will diminish. And there's something to that argument. The problem is that there's a lot less to that argument than it gets taken to. And so Jennifer's exactly right. We've created this fetish around secrecy, so that there's this sense of entitlement that, we can just adopt all of these technologies and use them until somebody catches us. And in fact, there's this incredible story, Compton, in LA, but was using overhead high-resolution surveillance planes, and they got caught, and it became a news story. And when the public information officer for the LA Sheriff's Department was asked about it, he said, and this is a quote, we knew that people would be uncomfortable with this sort of big brother eye in the sky, so we decided just not to tell them. So imagine a government official in any other context saying something like that. And I think the message is just, we do need these principles. I think George has an interesting idea about national regulation. At the policing project that I run, we're writing principles for best practices for policing agencies. George is part of a national effort to actually write principles for policing, but I think we do need this set of baseline principles where we all come together and say, this is how we want the technology to be used.
We have a lot of questions, and I'm not going to go to them just yet, because Jennifer, I want to pose a question to you, because I learned some very interesting facts from reading Unwarranted. Law enforcement seems to have this unceasing desire for information held by communications and information companies. And Professor Freeman writes that in 2012, AT&T took in $8 million by turning over information to law enforcement. And that in 2013, it came to light that AT&T had placed its own employees in-house with the DEA. And we are all aware that in 2016, law enforcement tried to force Apple to decrypt data on a mobile phone used by one of the San Bernardino terrorists. Now, these companies, Google, Apple, Facebook, AT&T, these are called third-party holders of our information. Law enforcement goes to third-party holders to get information, not about us, but not to us. They don't come to us, they go to them. So why is it that way, and what rights do we, individuals, have to stop these third-party holders from handing over our information if we don't want it shared? Another follow-up, does law enforcement have to serve warrants on these companies, these third-party holders, first to get our information?
Yeah. So thanks for asking me this question. The reason, it's not just, I mean, technology has changed policing and changed our relationship to data, not just because of these tools that are specifically designed for policing, like stingrays or cameras or those body cameras, but also because we now voluntarily use technology that generates and collects all this information about us, from the cell phones, which are basically tracking beacons, which we all carry with us day and night, to Facebook, Gmail, Twitter, Instagram, whatever social network or third-party service you might use. It's all this communications and information about us, who our friends are, who we know, is all up there online. And police go there because it's a one-stop shop. It's a quick repository, and you don't necessarily have to let the target know that you're there doing a search and taking all of the information. So it's just a huge amount of information. There's no danger in going to get it, and you can hide notice from people and when you grab it. So it's it's just a sea change in the amount of information that is available about us these days. And I think that, when you talk about $8 million, it's not that these companies are making money giving this information to law enforcement. That's the costs of compliance. It gives you a sense of the scope of what they're turning over. But no, it's not like a profit center for them, but they do have this information. They're subject to the law, and legal process is served, and they have to turn it over. But one of the biggest battles that we have now from a civil civil liberties privacy perspective is what kind of legal process? Because a warrant in U.S. law is one of the most privacy protective forms of legal process, because you have to go to a judge, an independent person, and gap probable cause. But there are all kinds of other legal process that might be served. And so the question is, does the Fourth Amendment apply to this information or not? And
is it a search or not?
Yeah, and that's the question of whether it's a search or not. Search is a term of art under the Fourth Amendment, and it means that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the information. And what the government has argued, the Department of Justice, is that you don't have an expectation of privacy in information that's held about you by third parties, because third parties have access to it. So in other words, the argument is kind of, if it's not secret, it's not private, and if it's not private, the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply, and we don't need to go get a warrant. We can either just ask for the information, or there's some form of lesser process under federal law, like a national security letter or a subpoena based on some kind of just mere relevance standard, whereby we can get all this very personal data.
So government says that we have to use these third party companies to be able to use our phones. And because we have to do it, they're saying, well, you've just given up your expectation of privacy.
Right.
And that's like, Professor Friedman, in your book, it's the law now that when you put your trash out, you no longer have an expectation of privacy in your trash. So police can go through your trash without getting a warrant. But as you point out in your book, you put your trash out because government mandates that that's how you get your trash collected. Right? So it's
really taking advantage of the way that modern living has evolved. And, you know, this is something that we're challenging. The ACLU has a case, United States versus Carpenter, that's going to be heard in the Supreme Court at the end of this month. And it will be about cell phone location data. So when you call or you get a text message for billing purposes, the company will keep a record of the cell phone tower your phone connected to. And that can provide location information about where you are. And the question is that information protected by the reasonable expectation of privacy, and thus you need a warrant for it or not? The case could be decided very narrowly about that particular category of data, or it could have a much broader impact where the court says something about this whole notion that information that's held about you by, or that is your information in the hands of third parties, doesn't have Fourth Amendment protection, and the court may decide that that's not actually, that the government's argument is wrong, and that's not actually the case. So U.S. versus Carpenter is a potentially extremely important Fourth Amendment case that we'll be litigating at the end of this month.
Probably the most important Fourth Amendment case we've seen in a very long time, because, you know, the court got us into this box by saying that anything you turn over to a third party is fair game without a warrant. And, you know, now that there's some signals that the court's going to clamp down on that in this case, because the idea that the government can get your sort of location at every moment from your cell phone carrier may just be a step too far.
Again, in California, yes, you have to get a warrant, so just so that you know that.
Right.
And this is, you know, quite frankly, this is a diversity of our nation, right? There are 50 different states. They're very different one from the other. So as to local and state law enforcement, they have to get a warrant.
Federal law enforcement is governed by federal law.
Right.
But that is one of the reasons why I like the kind of, you know, 50-state experiment, because yep, California has this opportunity to be a leader and to show the rest of the country, you know, you can protect people's privacy and let law enforcement do its job at the same time.
So the lesson here is stay calm and live in California?
It's not bad.
No, I think you should be pushing the envelope all the time, but we are at least we are a little further ahead than some other folks.
You know, another reason, there are many reasons to read this book, is that we've talked about, for example, courts, and, you know, you can go to court. You can go to court and you can see what's happening in the courts, but you can't go to all courts. So FISA courts, for example, right?
Yeah.
And can you just maybe 30 seconds on that? Then we're going to go to questions.
Sure. So the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is a statute that was put in place to deal with the government conducting surveillance to protect national security from outside, from other countries. And there are special standards that apply in those situations. Jennifer's actually kind of an expert about all of this. But the court that issues the warrants in those cases operates in secret in the District of Columbia. It's not an open court. And it's the court that approved a lot of the surveillance that went on when the Bush administration finally decided to go to any court before it collected all of our telephone metadata, some of our internet information. And that court, well, let me just actually take one step back. You know, when I learned, as everybody did, from Edward Snowden's revelations about what the government was doing, I was, to be honest, outraged. And I should be clear about my outrage, because to this day, I'm not sure how I feel about the substance of what the government was doing, whether it makes sense to collect all of that data and try to data mine to keep us safe. I think it's a mistake to portray, folks as sort of for or against the government. We all want to be safe, and therefore, you know, maybe it made sense. But the notion that the government would do this without asking permission from anyone just blew me away. And then when it did decide that it wanted some permission, it went to this FISA court. And the FISA court decisions, I mean, this is back to my judge thing, and I apologize to my friends who are judges, but many of them are just simply implausible. I mean, I've been teaching law for 30 years, and you read them and you think, really? Like, judges thought this was okay and that it was within the statutory authority? And, you know, that's precisely the kind of thing that we got to keep an eye on. And, you know, Jennifer may want to jump in here, but in December, the Congress is going to have to re-up to reauthorize some of that kind of foreign surveillance. And my own position on it is, you know, a lot of it's fine if it's aimed outside of the United States. I mean, we can deal with other countries as we will. It's a tough world. But whenever that surveillance is aimed at residents and citizens of the United States, then the Fourth Amendment has just got to apply. And I don't see any other way to understand things.
Yeah. You know, I think that for people who care about this issue, I'll just say this is an exceedingly important political moment because of this law that's going to expire in December. And basically, we have a statute that allows targeting people who are non-U.S. persons outside the country, but it results in the collection of an immense amount of very private communications of Americans, both when we talk to those foreigners and when we talk to each other, because of the technology they use to collect this information. It's supposed to be used for foreign intelligence, but once that information is collected, the FBI is allowed to search it, not for foreign intelligence, not for national security, but for evidence of run-of-the-mill crimes using email addresses and other identifiers of Americans without getting a warrant, which is something that we call the backdoor search loophole. Normally, you wouldn't be able to get somebody's emails and phone calls without getting either a warrant or a wiretap warrant. But this is what's happening. It also allows for searching of communications for information about people. So if you and I are talking about something of foreign intelligence interest, that can be collected too, even though the target is not a party to that communication. And foreign intelligence is an extremely broad category. So Congress is considering what we didn't know this. It's because of Edward Snowden that we know that this is how they're using this law, and we know how significant the impact of this law is on American privacy. I mean, we have an opportunity to reform this law at the end of the year, but it's not going to happen unless people care and call your congressperson. Senator Feinstein actually came out in the past week or so saying that she believes that a warrant is absolutely needed for the FBI to search this repository of data for information about Americans. So she's on the right side of this, and we need to encourage our lawmakers to put together a bill that actually will fix this problem.
And remember that warrants aren't just, I'm going to go ask a judge, a law enforcement person, I'm going to ask a judge to just sign this so I can search your house or your phone. A warrant, the Fourth Amendment, all requires there must be probable cause to issue the warrant. So it's on law enforcement to convince a judge that there is probable cause that a warrant should be issued. In one sentence, each of you, one sentence only, your opinion of Edward Snowden.
My children call him mommy's friend, Edward Snowden, because without him, I didn't know almost anything about the career that I've spent my life working on.
Okay. George?
Well, one sentence.
One sentence.
A mix, because I believe that what he revealed as to system problems was important to be able to correct some of the mistakes that were being made or intentional misbehavior. On the other hand, I happen to know that this has put the life of many Americans at risk, and you know there are intelligence officers that have died as a result of this release of information.
Barry?
Yeah, I think it's a mix. None of us should countenance the kind of release of information in which he engaged, and yet we would all be in the dark. And the fact that we were all in the dark is a symptom of, I think, a great illness around this broad subject of policing.
Great. I'm going to go to audience questions, and I'm trying to group these in subject matters, so some of them are repetitive. Here's a question, and anyone can tackle it. And I'd like you, if you can keep your answers to maybe 30 seconds, we have a whole stack of cards here. We'll try to get through them. Are there real threats that warrant an increase of power and authority to local police departments?
I don't think so.
Do we ever want to give them more authority than they have?
Yeah, so the reason, what led me to start to write this book, which I explain in the preface, was in the aftermath of 9/11, actually an incredible thing happened. So I live in Greenwich Village, and like many people in New York, you know, watch live what was happening. I can sort of tell you where I was at every moment of that day. And after it, Sandra Day O'Connor came to the law school for groundbreaking of one of our buildings, and she said, you know, in light of the world in which we're now living, we're going to have to see a retraction of some of our civil liberties. And, you know, that may or may not have been true, but the fact that a sitting Supreme Court justice had said that out loud, and I'm a big Sandra Day O'Connor fan, just really struck me. And I started to talk to people about this, and, you know, people were all the sort of, we really need to crack down, we need to give law enforcement more authority. And I'd say, like what? And often people couldn't think of anything, but if they could, they'd say, you know, well, we need to let law enforcement do X or Y. And I said, well, they already can. They've been allowed to do it for years. And then people were outraged. And I was like, okay, you can't have it both ways. And it led me to realize, you know, people had no clue about how permissive we'd been about the government's authority to conduct surveillance on the rest of us. And that was one of the big motivators to write the book.
Wow. Another question. Should the practice of citizens recording police officers during questioning behavior be encouraged? Does it have a similar effect on officers' conduct as body cameras? So in California, it is lawful, and an officer cannot stop you from recording a police officer, video, audio, as long as it's in public and you're not interfering. So the question is, should that be encouraged, do you think?
I mean, look, I think that as a police officer, you're a public servant. And when you're working, you're working for the people, you're working for your community, and you should be very comfortable being video, being recorded during the performance of your duties. And if you are not, then you may need to consider another line of work. So I personally believe that it's a healthy process. I think it's important also to recognize that videos are a two-dimensional account of a multidimensional incident. And I know that often that creates huge problems when you see videos of a particular event, but you may not know everything else that was going on. But I think that, you know, I'm a true believer that more information, not less information, is healthier. So why not have it, put it out there, and let the process hopefully assist in coming up with whatever the truth or the matter happens to be in that incident.
Okay. So another question, what are fusion centers? And I'm going to direct this to Professor Friedman because there's something in your book I read about fusion centers. And could you talk about Virginia and what they did?
Sure. So, you know, in the aftermath of 9/11, the 9/11 Commission, the question was, you know, what went wrong? And one of the things that was said was that we had failed to connect the dots, that we had the information available, but we simply hadn't assimilated it. And so the idea was that the federal government would fund fusion centers that would fuse all of the data and information that we had in one place. And fusion centers were created all over the country. The problem is the federal government didn't feel that it had the authority to regulate them. It just funded them. And many of the states that set them up didn't regulate them at all. And so there are these entities that exist that are just, you know, sucking in great quantities of information and trying to do something with it. I actually have no, and I'm curious if George does, I have no sense whatsoever of the payoff of fusion centers. I know that there was a Senate investigation of them that found them to be just a scandal. the conduct in which the folks at the Fusion Centers was engaging was extraordinary in terms of what was being collected and the kind of surveillance that was done, and unclear that they'd ever had a payoff in terms of actually catching somebody we cared about. In Virginia, a Fusion Center identified as a threat sort of activist students in historically black colleges and universities, and suggested that we engage in surveillance of those individuals, which...
What do you mean, those individuals? You mean all black students?
I hard to know, though, I knew that you were curious about this, so I went online earlier today and looked at... Some of you might have seen the FBI issued an intelligence report indicating that there was, a threat to law enforcement from people associated with Black Lives Matter and other organizations like that. And though there undoubtedly have been officers who have been killed, there's been an uptick in killing of officers that we should all be concerned about. The idea that that what we should do is conduct surveillance on or consider as a threat anybody that engages in an activist movement is, to me, extraordinarily troubling.
Yeah, I think what you may be referring to, I just remember reading recently that this Justice Department under this administration has identified a suspect group, and they're called Black Extremists. Black identity extremists.
Black identity extremists, BIA.
And I have no idea what that is. I have no clue, but that is now another category that the Justice Department, now under the FBI, under which it is under, the FBI, is now decided that's going to be a suspect group, whatever that may mean.
Worthy of more attention and yes. More surveillance and increased funding to monitor. And this just proves, what history shows, which is that when you have these powers, that the risk is that they are disproportionately turned against people who are activists, people who are in vulnerable communities, people who are seeking political change, people, African Americans or people who are religious minorities. And that's just exactly what that symbolizes.
Here's a question. Would tougher gun laws...
I think George was going to tell
us.
George,
well, and I think to Barry's earlier point, the problem is the government, they took an idea that has some merit. There were a lot of... there was a tremendous disconnect that probably allowed September 11th, the incident to occur the way that it did. The information was residing in many places. Left hand, right hand weren't talking to one another. And the goal, I think it was a noble one, is how do we get all these people to work together to collaborate to protect the common good? But what occurred is that the funding came with really no clear idea how this was going to take place, and it was really left to local regional authorities, not even states, to decide how this was going to work, what was going to be the interaction between the different agencies, how information was going to be collected, disseminated. And therefore, what we have is which I think is a product, quite frankly, of 17,000 law enforcement agencies in this country. You have all these different disparate ways of handling information, quite frankly, often either completely worthless, other times perhaps misused in targeting people of a certain color, a certain religion. There's a thing called suspicious activity reports, SARs. And if you look at what some of the things are, it's ridiculous. But, all of it came up with the whole concept that started in New York. If you see something, say something. Made total sense as a slogan in order to get the public to understand they had a role in self-policing, but that immediately had, translated into crazy stuff. A foreign-looking individual taking a photo of the Transamerica building. What the hell does that look like? I don't know. So pretty soon that's an SAR, and then people are ramped up about that kind of information. So,
wow. Another question. Would tougher gun laws increase the ability of police to protect civilians?
You're asking me?
Anyone?
Yeah.
So, and I know that I'm probably going to get death threats tonight, but... we are enamored with guns in this country, and we have gotten to the point that we go beyond reasonableness in any way or shape, and we're very hypocritical about it, right? I mean, we pick when we want to pick, right? The New York terrorist, by God, he was a terrorist. We should hang him, Guy goes out and kills 26 people in Texas. Well, he's mentally ill, right? Or a guy goes and kills about 50 people in in Las Vegas, he, you know, we don't want to talk about politics now. Let's deal with this later. You know, we have more guns than we have people in this country. And I believe that, you know, certainly people have the right to use weapons for sports. But the kind of weaponry that we see around this country, you know, and in some places, you know, with complete unfettered access, is weapons that were designed for a theater of war. They were not designed to be operated within an urban environment, certainly not within civilized society. But, you know, we lack the political will to do something about this. You know, I remember when Sandy Hook occurred, I said, okay, I think the water finally hit the level. You know, if we as a society can get angry and outraged at the killing of little kids, what does it say about us as a society? And you know what? We don't have anybody to blame by ourselves, by the way. But I'm sorry.
I have to take issue a little bit. I think that most people in this country, indeed, were outraged and want these changes to happen. Where they have to happen is within Congress. And quite frankly, I believe that most Democrats in Congress were pushing as hard to get gun control when President Obama was in, and you had GOP people pushing back. And if they're in the majority, it's just not going to happen. So I don't think the blame so much. I think we're pushing, but there's so much we can do.
But those Republicans are put there by Americans. Now, we may disagree with their political beliefs and support, but they're not. I mean, it's not a Martian that put somebody in Congress, right? It was some of us. We may not like what they say or believe, but they're being placed there by us. I don't mean necessarily us in this room. I'm talking about us with a capital U. So I just, you know, I'm sorry. This is emotional for me. I get angry about it. I just don't think that we can continue to blame other forces. I think that we're just not angry enough. Let me put it this way.
You know, what's interesting is the difficulty that the gun laws are posing for law enforcement. So there have been cases brought to the Supreme Court. It's not clear that they're going to hear them, but involving the question of whether when you see a gun, it's even probable cause to look now because, you know, it's lawful to carry a gun. And so I'm very interested to watch over time the way law enforcement reacts to the gun laws, which in many ways jeopardize the lives of law enforcement more than anyone else.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that law enforcement isn't in the forefront of pushing for gun control. I mean, it would make their lives safer if indeed these kinds of controls were put in place. But I don't hear law enforcement out in front saying, let's have gun control. I mean,
here's the crazy stuff. If you're in possession of a Valley Club, that's a felony in California.
Right, a Billy Club.
Yeah,
right,
Billy Club. If you're in possession of a gun and you're not a prohibited possessor, it's a misdemeanor. And generally, a misdemeanor is very hard to prosecute. I often joke that we don't have a Billy Club lobby, and that's why it continues to be a felony, right? Yeah, brass knuckles, felony. Gun, not a felony.
Well, that gets to, again, our legislature and we the people. What are we saying to our legislators here in California about changing these laws? Here is a question from a pessimist, and this is going to have to be our last question. Are we living in the worst time of police overreach and lack of civilian or public oversight? If not, when was it worse?
You know, I want to jump on this. I don't necessarily think this is a worse time. I think actually what you're seeing is a healthy process where information that before was unknown to you and to us as a public is now becoming public information. I don't think policing today is any worse than it was maybe 20 years ago. Technology is different. And to the, you know, Jennifer's point, there's a lot of technology clearly that wasn't there before. And that brings a whole different host of issues and control issues. But the reality is actually that I think it's healthy that increasingly people are more aware. I think that, you know, the fact that everybody walks around with a video camera today, you know, most of the cases that we have all been angry about, you know, with police excessive force, would not have been publicly known but for the fact that there was somebody there with a cell phone to video that. And I think that eventually that leads to actually creating better policing. And eventually, quite frankly, although many people in law enforcement disagree with me, I think actually when you reduce the level of force that police is using and you control that, actually it becomes a safer environment for police officers. I happen to have friends that are in law enforcement in other countries where very seldom the police has to use deadly force or any force at all, quite frankly. And those officers are much more safer than American law enforcement officers are. So I think actually reducing violence in the, both from the policing end and from the other side by exposing all this is a good thing. And I think we're in a better place today than we were before.
I also am optimistic. It's definitely not the worst of times. I mean, if you look back at what policing was like in the early part of the 1900s with going after socialists and communists and the labor movement, what race relations were like back then, the sort of utter absence of the First Amendment, the idea that the Fourth Amendment only applied if a property right was implicated, these were pretty bad times for civil liberties. And I think, again, if you go back and you look at the church committee reports about what kind of political surveillance was taking place during the 50s and 60s, observing the anti-war movement activists during the Vietnam era, women's rights activists, civil rights leaders, that, there's some really atrocious stuff that was going on then too. I think we tend to go in, cycles, and, there's some dark times and there's some bright times and for different reasons. So I think technology poses a challenge. But it's not a challenge that we can't overcome. So there's really no reason to throw up your hands and give up. There are definitely things we can do, and we have things to work with. We have in some ways much more enlightened legal doctrine than we did in other eras in the past. And I feel like I feel optimistic that we can do things that will matter to help keep people secure and free with those tools.
Let me pick up on that and give you all a final question. The Los Angeles Board of Police Commissioners, a 5-member civilian oversight body, voted last month to allow the LAPD to use drones in a 1-year pilot program, but only after vigorous public debate. In New York, the city council introduced a bill to require the NYPD to disclose any surveillance technology it uses and to make public the policies about restrictions on the use of this technology. But Mayor de Blasio poured cold water on it, saying the bill, quote, provides a roadmap for the bad guys, potentially aiding criminals or terrorists by making them privy to information about law enforcement tactics. So in this era of 21st century policing, we have to find a balance. We've got to balance our need for national security against our right to know what law enforcement is doing. So, to my panelists, to wrap up, what one thing do you recommend be done to balance these two competing interests, national security and our right to know?
Well, right now, the balance is utterly out of whack on the side of secrecy. And so there needs to be serious declassification of the immense amount of information about what surveillance is being done and how that currently is either classified in the intelligence context or sealed in the law enforcement context. Mm-hmm. And only once we have that could we even begin to talk about getting back into balance.
George?
Yeah, I think that, this is an area that, again, I think that there is a need to have greater local control. I think that policies and how equipment is purchased, what are the guidelines upon which the equipment is going to be deployed, should be discussed at the local level, and policies should be developed accordingly. And I think that, at the more global level, I think California is heading in the right direction, given that we are required, starting January of 2016, to use search warrants for the deployment of all this type of technology to collect data, how the data is going to be used. So are we perfect? No, but we're certainly in the right direction.
Professor Freeman.
Yeah, so, the lesson of the book and of the policing project that I run is all of this is your responsibility. It's easier to want to put your head in the sand and say law enforcement's going to make us safe, but any time that the government, law enforcement does anything, it's in your name. And so you need to ask questions, you need to insist on having a voice, and then we need to, have the kind of reasonable disagreement that we have all the time in this country. Sometimes we have a lot of unreasonable disagreement, but the kind of reasonable disagreement that leads us to answers that we're comfortable with.
Well, thank you to our panelists, Barry Friedman, professor of law and director of the Policing Project at New York University and author of the new book, Unwarranted, Policing Without Permission. It's a terrific read. George Gascon, district attorney for the City and County of San Francisco, and Jennifer Granick, Surveillance and Cybersecurity Counsel for the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. We want to remind everyone here that copies of Professor Friedman's book are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign them following this program. I am Judge Ladaris Cordell, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.